A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Hello, and welcome to The Spectre, a podcast of the Communist Party, USA. We sat down between all the business of our 31st National Convention, in part celebrating our 100th anniversary, and discussed democratic centralism, what it is, how we've seen it used at the convention, what our other experiences are with it, and what else we looked forward to at the convention. With us, we have Zach, Scott, Corey, and Lucia. Before we begin, all the resolutions we will talk about can be viewed in their final form at cpusa.org. And further resources on democratic centralism can be found on the Marxist Internet Archive at marxists.org.
We're here at the 31st National Convention of the Communist Party USA. I'm Scott.
I'm Zach.
I'm Corey. So you might hear a few little grunts and sounds in the background. That is our young 15-month-old comrade, Lucia, who will be joining us to give us her opinion, too.
Yes, and who's still mastering the art of party meetings. So what is democratic centralism?
So democratic centralism, as we understand it in the party, as Lenin has understood it, is a refocus on party discipline and unity in the democratic process. And so typically, in a democratic process, you will have, say, five people. Three want to do A, two want to do B. The A's have it, and all five do A. Unfortunately, in real life, that's not always how that works out, where those other two who do not agree with the decision, they'll just leave, they'll fight against you. And democratic centralism is a way to combat that disunity, that individualism, and to really make a straightforward process or plan of action.
You mentioned Lenin. When did he develop this, or in what context?
So Lenin developed this early on in his party, coming out of the Second International, seeing a lot of issues in that. I mean, that's all Lenin does is find issues in the Second International. But he's devising a way to figure out how his party can grow, how they can move forward, and how they can be successful in their future endeavors.
So just a quick clarification, when we talk about internationals, first international, second, third international, what are we talking about?
So the Second International was kind of revived after the first one, you know, stuttered out. These were a lot of the big socialist parties in the late 1800s, principally in Germany, France, Britain, Russia. They were looking a way to figure out a unified path, a more global idea and plan of action. And what Lenin saw in a lot of their discussions, on their party makeup, is they were essentially revisionist. They weren't fully understanding Marx. They really cut back on the revolutionary spirit. They didn't put any backing behind it. It was just words to them. And so Lenin came in and started criticizing all that. And that's where we get new ideas that turn out to be successful.
And when we talk about these internationals came from the understanding that workers had common interests across national boundaries. So the goal was to not just organize workers in one plant or in one sector, but in all of the capitalist world. And Marx was one of the founders and organizers of the First International, which was then succeeded by the Second, which collapsed when many socialist parties turned from the unity in the cause of peace, opposition to World War I, turned towards support of their national ruling classes. And that led to the collapse of the Second International and eventually the foundation of the Third, which was the Communist International.
Correct.
So it was a way of, Zach, you said, enforcing sort of a discipline, making sure that everybody was proceeding along the same path.
Yeah, because what we tend to see in our more capitalistic and liberal and bourgeois governments and politics is it's a very individualistic approach one person can do this, one person can do that. When in just general Marxist theory, we express solidarity, that people from all around need to come together and push forward as the workers. And so developing this idea fights this individualism, and people like Mao go on to really hammer this point home, where it comes to a point of ultra-democracy, described as when people vote to do something, if it's that 5-2 example again, those two people just don't do anything, or they fight against you instead of actually going along with the plan.
Communists don't have a monopoly on this sort of style of decision-making, although we certainly practice it. It seems like a sort of technology that the working class has sort of developed for itself.
So I think there's different ways of, there's different focuses that you can have when talking about democratic centralism, and I think it plays out in different ways at different points in history and in different organizations and kind of where you are. It's not like one set thing. It's kind of a dynamic concept. And I think, you know, one focus, one way to look at it is that kind of the centralism part of it, the focus on that kind of unifying force. But the other part is the democratic part of it. And I think a lot of it is about making sure that decisions are made democratically. And that's a huge portion of what goes into it. So there is a process in democratic centralism that allows for lots of people to have input, for everybody to kind of work together, to be dialectical and to kind of play off of each other and really work together to come up with a plan or a strategy or, you know, an outlook that best captures everybody's interests. And then once you come up with that decision, then, you know, you enforce it kind of in a centralistic tendency. So basically to say, you know, we all came up with this together, we had a healthy debate, and now we're going to unify behind this idea that we came up with. And I think it's also a concept that has moments where you need more strict discipline one way or the other. So sometimes the centralism is the key part of it, and sometimes the democratic part is the key part. So in the example of the labor movement, you know, you have a debate and you call strike vote and everybody votes. And if you vote to strike, then everybody strikes whether you voted for it or not. That's the kind of discipline that goes into it. And that's one of those instances where that strict kind of, this is what we voted on and this is what we're going to do, is going to be necessary. And then there's other moments in time when you can be more open to having more kind of debate and more discussion and having multiple kind of ways of approaching things.
Getting back to the idea of sort of individualism and the way that capitalist culture handles democracy. So capitalist democracy tends to center on the idea, as Lucia is demonstrating, of having a voice. So everything's about, you know, do you have a voice? Are you allowed to speak? Are you allowed to say what you want? And that's great. It's very important. And Lenin recognized how important the sort of right to freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, all of that was. On the other hand, you know, socialist democracy, communist democracy is also about the working class achieving and holding power. And the working class does not achieve power by asking for it. The working class does not achieve power by saying that it should be in control. It's more than having a voice. You actually have to organize and work together and work in a unified way to take charge of, put yourself in leadership, put the working class in leadership of the democratic movement, and eventually the working class in leadership of society as a whole. So democratic centralism is really, in a certain sense, it's just democracy. Right, it's a working class revolutionary socialist vision of how democracy works, where we all debate, everyone participates, we decide what we're going to do, and we move forward together. How has that looked at the convention here?
Yeah, so it's looked really well because we have been having these robust discussions. We've been having our resolution gets forward, it gets read, we talk about it in groups, and then we bring it back to the convention as a whole and talk about it on the floor. Have further discussion, further debates, further observations, and then we bring it to a vote. Do we agree on this? Do we not agree on this? Are there any amendments? And then it passes or fails.
And this process, you know, the convention, the physical gathering here is the kind of high point, but this process has been going on for 4 months now. The beginning of February, we released our new draft program. That's one of the big things before this convention. A new document guiding, like, framework for the work of the party. We had 4 months of public discussion, webinars, all sorts of stuff. We had a whole other process where people could submit revisions and amendments to the program. People could submit resolutions that were then edited and amended. And so this was a very long process culminating in the votes here. So we've been talking a lot about unity. Marxists are not known for their ability to agree with one another. They agree with one another by arguing. Are there contentious issues that this convention has had to treat, or are there areas where people disagree?
I think that at this point, you know, we're at a, what we always say, but we're at a historical moment when things are bad, when we're in a rough situation and there's a lot of really dangerous things going on. And so I think you see the party kind of reacting to that in the way that we would expect with democratic centralism, which is to kind of come together and to really be focusing on unity, to recognize that it's really important that we are together right now and that's how we're going to be able to push forward and kind of fight against some of the really serious threats that are facing the working class right now. So I think what we're seeing right now is we had that process of debate in the pre-convention discussion period, and you know, and there's some debate going on now, but I think what we're really seeing is that everybody feels it's a scary time and that we really need to come together and we really have to push hard. And that means, you know, being united and really working together.
One example of an issue that was really prominent in pre-convention discussion was the question of our youth work and specifically of the Young Communist League. Zach, you're involved in the youth work of the party. Can you kind of give us a sense of the contours of that question? What's involved in it?
Yeah, so a lot of what's involved there is both having the interest at the youth level to go forward with this, to have the dedication, the people, and some plans, but also to present these ideas to the greater body, to the party as a whole, and to convince them to say, hey, this is a good idea. You should back us on this. We're not going to go anywhere without new people, and the youth are the new people. So we're trying to push that line, and you know, some people say, oh, we had it, and it's all for a reason. Others are like, oh, yeah, let's go all in. And so finding those arguments to talk to people is really good. It's healthy. It makes a robust discussion. To jump back on democratic centralism as a concept, it's more about the journey than the destination. It's about how we get there, not necessarily what we get to.
And on the youth work and on a couple of other questions that were before the party, there was a process that we called the unity process, which is really just, again, democracy or democratic centralism at work. But on the youth question, some leaders of the party convened a meeting with youth involved in the party's work back in January, I believe. The idea came out of that, putting together a podcast, of which The Spectre is the product. And based on that, you know, that's emerging as one of the key areas of, you know, the party's youth work. And so when it was time to figure out how to proceed, the party asked editors of the website and the youth podcast initiative to sort of collaborate on what would work look like going forward. And we came up with a proposal that provides a path to the reestablishment of the Young Communist League by building youth initiatives in districts. So it really addresses the concerns that some comrades had about the youth work, but also adopts and really pushes the goal of the refoundation of the YCO. It's an example of how, you know, ideas shift and emerge and take shape over the course of this process.
And to clear up some other things here too, we're saying, you know, it's just like democracy and all that. I mean, there are details to it, and that's not to discount them. Things like the secret ballot, be able to propose and withdraw amendments or propositions or even people at any time, things that you would think are part of a robust democracy, but aren't always the case. And so when you start to look at the details of it a lot more, you see how democratic centralism really makes a path of its own. And that's something to be aware of when you're looking further and further into this concept. These aren't details we're necessarily going to dive into too deeply, but it's something to be aware of.
How does democratic centralism maybe protect the right of oppressed people to participate, or people facing special oppression, women, racially and nationally oppressed people? How does it enable us to include their voices?
One way is through its very nature of being democratic. We're trying to get everyone in all the time, no matter who they are or what their opinions are. In terms of addressing other demographics or oppressed peoples, we try to amplify their voices as best we can. We try to get more forward on the speaking stack. If it's a topic that affects them more directly, they're the ones that should be having that conversation. Others should be moving back and listening. Their experiences or their knowledge aren't the same. but also just through the journey that is this system. Theoretically, the best arguments, the best ideas, the most robust ideas, detailed plans will win out. And those plans come from the people that experience them the most.
And so, the people who are most involved in the work.
Yeah. And so when we give them an opportunity to speak, we're not barring anyone from speaking. Those ideas, those plans, those experiences come out, and it really adds to what we say, what we do, and what we're planning. Ensuring that they have an opportunity to speak. Further, the putting forward and withdrawing of ideas. People who put forward an idea and it turns out later that it's a bad idea, or it affects more people than we thought, or that we didn't hear a certain voice, we can withdraw that idea. It's not set in stone by any means. It's a very malleable process. So those who are oppressed, those who don't have a voice necessarily, or at least not all the time, are given that extra opportunity within this system.
It's sort of like democracy done consciously.
Well, capitalism also takes the approach like everybody has the right to it. Now, whether or not they have the ability to do that, you know, to participate or do it is a different question. So we see that a lot in like voter suppression and, you know, ID voter ID laws and that kind of thing. So I think what we try to do is not just say everybody's equal, everybody has a right, now, you know, go fight to be able to actually exercise your right. But we actually try to recognize the historical situation, historical oppression, like factors that may put some people at disadvantage or make their voices just less heard in general. And we try to bring those people to the front and make sure that, you know, their voices are heard here in our organization and that we're really listening to those people and making sure that they're at the front, which is a really concrete thing. And I mean, you see it in our convention by literally having somebody grab the women standing at the back of the speaker's line and putting them in front. And it's really wonderful to see this happening and to see our white male comrades be really open to this idea too, to really stepping back and letting other people whose voices are less heard be able to speak.
Corey, you're the only one of us here that's actually lived in a socialist country. You were in Cuba. Is democratic centralism part of their democratic process?
Absolutely. So interesting, one of the criticisms that Cuba gets sometimes is, you know, for being undemocratic because it's a one-party state. And it's interesting because politics just works a lot differently there. So it is, in fact, only one party. But what you see instead of parties there are kind of interest groups. So you have an organization of like students, you have an organization of youth, you have an organization of workers, you have an organization of women, organization of teachers and structure workers. So kind of different sectors of the country are represented in these different organizations and bodies, and they all bring forward the goals, the special needs of those of each of those groups. They're all kind of given a place at the table. And so that conversation comes together to create kind of ideas for where the country's going and what things are most pressing. And then you see, a lot of times, like one of the examples you see it express, the Cubans have like years that are like themed on a certain thing. So the first year I lived there was the year of the energy revolution. And so that was bringing together the need to create energy and also to create jobs and kind of different interests. It also involved things around green energy. And they were able to bring together all these different opinions about what was important and bring it together into this one goal. And that was like the goal that they worked towards for that year.
Can you actually tell us briefly why you were in Cuba and give us a plug?
Oh, yeah. So I was in Cuba from 2006 to 2012, and I studied medicine at the Latin American School of Medicine, also called ELAM, which is a free medical school that was started by the Cubans in 1997. And the goal was to train people from medically underserved areas to practice medicine, to go back to their home areas to provide much needed medical care. So I was a part of that mission, and that school continues to exist and continues to accept applicants. So anybody who is interested in studying medicine and working in underserved areas should definitely check it out.
And what organization should they contact?
So you can go to the website www.ifconews.org. That's www.ifconews.org. and find information about the Latin American School of Medicine. And you can also check out MEDIC, which is spelled M-E-D-I-C-C, and they have some information there too.
Zach, based on the convention so far, what do you think the work going forward is going to be? What are the big issues?
So right now going forward, addressing the Green New Deal, to get some support and to bring them back to our clubs and districts to not only create further support, but find ways that local areas can make this a broader conversation about ecology, about eco-socialism, about really addressing our impending crisis. We've discussed voter rights and minority suppression in terms of how people aren't heard, how the voting process here isn't very democratic at all. It leaves a lot of people out, and how we address a lot of these issues, along with we're going to be hearing some anti-imperialist resolutions this afternoon, which I'm very excited for, and how we can address those both locally, regionally, and nationally, building coalitions, organizing people, and also building a party for it. We ourselves can do more about it.
And that's exactly what we're doing. Since the convention, many of the resolutions have been adopted, and in those resolutions, one of them at least, is to build the party greater. A few were to give our support to countries suffering under the boot of imperialism, specifically U.S. imperialism, along with our support for a Green New Deal, and making that a broader conversation to continue that fight for a sustainable future. Now, as we have seen, democratic centralism is a key tenet to Marxism-Leninism, the founding basis of our party. What it allows for is a robust democracy, coupled with a strong unifying force to ensure that our resolutions are put into action. What critics may often say about democratic centralism is that it is quote-unquote authoritarian, and clearly it is not. The only addition is that once a decision is made, it is followed through. That is the whole point of democratic centralism, or else it would just be called plain old democracy again, and we'd be no better than the anarchists, or the liberals, or anyone else who preaches democracy but doesn't actually practice it. We want to thank you for listening. If this was your first time tuning in, the Spectre can be found on a wide range of platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. We also encourage you to look forward to additional episodes that will be coming out in the coming weeks, and to check out the Communist Party at cpusa.org.
Democracy. We're democratating.